And welcome everybody to the Untold History Channel. My name is Ron Partain, and tonight it's gonna be fun. Tonight we're gonna go through the Bad War. A lot of you guys, some of you probably remember I had Mike King on about, I don't know when was that I had Mike on. I'm drawing a brain fart here. That's what happens when you get old. You suffer from CRS. 10 days ago, I had Mike King on, and that was we did the 120-year timeline, the Q 120-year timeline of events. So, but there's another kind of hidden reason why I'm doing, why I'm going to be reading the entire book of Mike King's Bad War, because I have been talking to him and we are going to do a weekly show together on Tuesday nights. So after the Constitution class, I'm going to have a show where we, where Mike and I do something together. We've got, there's no shortage of stuff to talk about from a historical perspective, going through New World Order, all kinds of stuff. That man is an absolute just an absolute wealth of knowledge. And so we are going to do we're going to do something to where we do one day a week. And so I'm going to tack that on to the Constitution class. So, so that I have something to do, after that. So probably be, I'm guessing it'll probably be somewhere between a half an hour to an hour. So that, that kind of gives me a little bit of a tiny little break in between the Constitution class and whatever I do with Mike, but then that gives me probably about 2 hours worth of content for that I can put up on Tuesdays. So so that is coming up. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. Actually, I'm really looking forward to that. Mike is somebody that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. So that said, I was informed tonight that I need to let everybody in, I need to remind everybody about Detoxicream, about the EDTA cream, because you're all exposed to these toxic heavy metals that are out there. And not only that, but EDTA is proven, or is at least it was shown in the in the patent discovered by Karen Kingston, to neutralize the nasty stuff that's out there in the graphene oxide. So, and you can get that at detoxicream.com. So, I was asked I should be doing that. I should be talking about that more. I realize that I should be doing that. I don't know. I think you guys know that I'm not in this for the money, but I do need to pay bills. So, and if I have, something that's good for everybody as well. So it's not just, it's not me. It's a good trade, I guess, is probably the best way to say it. So anyway, that said, I'm going to jump in, and we are going to, I'm going to jump into the foreword of the book here. Let me go to, this is the foreword. Actually, I'm going to go up and you guys can see the, this is the cover of the book, The Bad War. And it's actually because World War II was ultimately called the Good War. And so it's the truth that was never taught about World War II. And, it was literally banned by Amazon. Amazon said, nope, you can't sell this anymore. So, and this is the third edition. I actually when I had Mike on the other night, I discovered that he has several more books that I haven't, that I didn't have. So what I did was I just upgraded my purchase, and got the latest editions. And the Bad War that I have, that I got in the next round, was actually an upgraded edition from the one that I had. So if you guys are looking for this, you actually are going to need to go and buy it yourself. Now, I have put a link in the comment section, or actually here, or not in the comment section, but in the in the description, but I'll also go here and put it in here so you guys can see it here. If it loads up, okay. So there's so the books. This is it right here. The Bad War, 316 pages, 600 illustrations, and it had 322 positive reviews on Amazon. So, but he's got a lot of really good books on here, a lot of really good books. But tonight we are focusing on The Bad War. Many of you guys are probably unfamiliar with Jeff Rentz. Jeff Rentz actually used to have a radio show, and he wrote the foreword to this. For over the past 30 years, I've worked in many key positions in broadcast journalism, TV news reporter, TV director, or news director, anchorman, and for the past 20 years, the producer and host of my own talk radio program. It has been quite a journey, and all during the times, I really never stopped wanting to know the realities of news stories, large and small, who, what, when, where, how, and most importantly, why. When applying those timeless questions towards the crucial subject of history, I have seldom been satisfied with the official explanations. For my inquiries and questions, the truth is not just out there, nor is it accessible. There is too much sleight of hand and structural criminality. That's one reason I'm so gratified that one of the most remarkable, insightful, truthful historians of today, M.S. King, has tackled the murky, imponderable subject of revisionist history, which is realistic history, with his sweeping epic, The Bad War, The Truth Never Taught About World War II. Though I am generally cautious in bestowing blessings upon the work of others, The Bad War caught my attention for a number of reasons. Through his essays submitted to Rentz.com, and also from his tour de force guest appearance on my show, Mike King's mastery of the subject, formidable writing talent, and unique ability to break down the complex into simple bites were already known to me. I was therefore pleased and excited to learn of his project to bring the truth of World War II to the average Joe and beyond. As my regular listeners and readers are by now well aware, the world situation becomes gloomier by the day. It is only through a clear understanding of the past that we can truly understand the present and the dark future that is being planned for us. By distilling real history into easy to understand illustrated mini essays, The Bad War serves as the perfect reference guide to help you navigate through the sea of lies which have been fed to us since childhood and continue to be fed to us each day. King's epic makes an utterly unique and important contribution to understanding the world, a contribution which we can all appreciate and all understand. So that is the introduction. So this is the table of contents. There are eight sections. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get through all eight of these. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it in like three parts, if it's going to be four parts, five parts, I don't know. I'm guessing I'm kind of shooting for four, could be five, But I mean, it's 313 pages, but it's not 313 pages of like really, really tiny writing. It's 313 pages of, you know, kind of like this text. So let's jump in, shall we? All right. Introduction. Aesop's Fable of the Man and the Lion. A man and a lion traveled together through the forest. They began to boast of their respective superiority to each other in strength and prowess. As they were disputing, they passed a statue carved in stone, which depicted a lion strangled by a man. The man pointed to it and said, "See there how strong we are and how we prevail over the king of beasts." The lion replied, "This statue was made by one of you men. If we lions erected statues, you would see the man placed under the paw of the lion." The lesson. One story is good till another is told. Interesting. During the 75 years which have now passed since the end of the grand history-altering event known as World War II, aka the Good War, only a single narrative of the great conflict has ever been or has been heard. It is a story which, as is always the case, has been scripted by the victors and pounded into the minds of all subsequent generations. Every medium of mass indoctrination has been harnessed to the task of training the obedient masses as to what the proper view of this event should be. Academia, news media, public education, book publishing, TV, documentaries, Hollywood films, clergymen, and politicians of every stripe all sing the same dreadful anthem. You know the familiar lyrics. Germany, Italy, and Japan tried to enslave the planet. The good guys of the world community banded together and stopped them, but not before millions were killed in Hitler's gas chambers. Literally, not a day seems to pass without some sort of media reference to this simplistic goofball narrative, a silly children's fable, which oh so conveniently ignores the previous decades of critical history leading up to World War II, omits vital information from the actual war years, and outright fabricates lie after lie after lie. Indeed, the official story amounts to a manufactured mendacity of such mountainous dimensions that the human mind will have a hard time processing the actual truth of the grand event, no matter how compelling the case may be. Because the moronic mantra is never questioned, the public mind quite naturally assumes it to be an undisputed truth, on par with the belief in 2 + 2 = 4. That is what differentiates mythology from an ordinary lie. Whereas a lie can be dispelled in a matter of minutes or days, at the most, myths can take 100 or more years to kill. Author Dresden James describes the group's psychology at play. A truth's initial commotion is directly proportional to how deeply the lie was believed. It wasn't the world being round that agitated people, but that the world wasn't flat. When a well-packaged web of lies has been sold gradually to the masses over generations, the truth will seem utterly preposterous and its speaker a raving lunatic. A fair warning, if you can't handle the emotional discomfort and intellectual humbling of having your fossilized worldview turned upside down and inside out by the pent-up truth volcano that is the bad war, you may want to put this book down or turn off the video. And now just walk away, because once you start to dig into the critical data points of World War II, rest or be assured that you'll not be able to refute the self-evident conclusions with which logically flow from those facts, unless, of course, you're insane. Myths die hard, as does the human ego. The object of life is not to be on the side of the majority, but to escape finding oneself in the rank of the insane. That was Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius. I really like that. The object of life is not to be on the side of the majority, but to escape finding oneself in the ranks of the insane. Very, very nice. Marcus Aurelius is one of the great Stoics of all time. Hello, Yarn. All right. Section 1, 1848 to 1913, planting the seeds of Europe's future world wars. In 1848, springtime of the people's pre-planned revolutionaries affect 50 countries. Pre-planned uprisings, similar to today's color revolutions, begin in Sicily in January of 1848. Soon after, revolts spontaneously break out in 50 states throughout Europe and South America. A mix of rebel reds and nationalist groups demand democracy, mob rule manipulated by the banking dynasties and globalists. Although there are legitimate grievances in any nation, and many of the 1848 reformers are sincere people with noble and nationalist visions, the higher purpose of the revolts is not to improve the lives of the people. The true goal is to subvert the authority of the existing imperial regimes and install smaller democratic states that can be easily controlled by agents working for the New World Order. The New World Order refers to a movement among banking media and academic elites, the legendary Rothschild family foremost among them, with philosophical roots dating back to the days of the French Revolution. The NWO envisions the future establishment of an integrated system of global governance to be erected upon the ruins of the old world order, a world based on sovereign and independent states, or independent nations or empires. The controlled revolutions wreak havoc, causing thousands of deaths and leading to political change in some states. Within a year, the revolutions will have been put down, but to the political structure of Europe has now been weakened by the slow poison of liberalism. Tsarist Russia, the hated enemy of the legendary globalist Rothschild family, is unaffected by the tumult of 1848, but not for long. It was 1848 was a big year for the globalists and their controlled pro-democracy mobs of communists, nationalists, Republicans, and assorted dupes of varying stripes. 1848, Karl Marx publishes the Communist Manifesto. As well-funded and well-organized revolutionary movements spread across Europe, German Jewish philosopher Karl Marx sets forth the goals of the communists. For all his lofty talk, his empty promises as of workers' paradise and social justice, the Communist Manifesto is just an intellectual mask for the Rothschild family's globalist plan to enslave humanity under a new world order. Marx's grandparents were actually related to the Rothschild family, though through marriage. The communists call for heavy income tax, a central bank with monopoly on credit, abolition of private land ownership and inheritance, state control over communication, education, manufacturing, agriculture, or medicine. Marx refers to this totalitarian scheme as dictatorship of the proletariat, or downtrodden masses. Marx's cult followers promote violence, class envy, and hostility towards free markets, family, business, tradition, and Christianity. In addition to the angry misfits and maladjusted criminals who worship Marx, there are many well-meaning idealists who fall for Marx's poisonous promises of a better world with security and prosperity for all. These useful idiots are known to this day as liberals or progressives. Their thoughtless idealism will unwittingly help the Reds and globalists greatly. One and two, the revolutionary philosophy and false promises of Marx and Engels will destabilize Europe for many years to come. Three, George Orwell's classic Animal Farm is an allegorical expose of what idealistic communism is really all about. It's 1846 to 1848. So the Mexican-American War was 1846 to 1848. Okay. I wasn't too far off. But, all right. 1865, Jewish mogul establishes Reuters news agency. The Reuters Telegram Company is the world's first major news organization established by Paul Reuter, born Israel Bir Yosefat. Reuters builds a reputation in Europe for being the first to report news scoops from abroad, such as Abraham Lincoln's assassination. Almost every major news outlet in the world today subscribes to Reuters services, which operates in over 200 cities in 94 countries and about 20 languages. The creation of the Reuters media empire marks the critical point in history when Jewish moguls begin to dominate the press of Europe and the United States. Through the Reuters family, though the Reuters family founded and heirs have since passed away, the public company today continues to vomit out pro-globalist and pro-Zionist propaganda. 1870 to 71, France starts and loses a war with the German state of Prussia. The Franco-Prussian War is a conflict between the French Empire of Napoleon III, a nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte, and the Germanic Kingdom of Prussia. Prussia is aided by a confederation of many smaller German states. The swift Prussian-German victory thwarts French ambitions in Central Europe and brings about the end of Napoleon III's rule. After the war, the French branch of the Rothschild family steps up with a massive bailout of the nearly bankrupt French government. The new government, the Third Republic, is again a democracy bought and paid for by the Rothschilds and under their influence more so than before. And this is Imperial France started the Franco-Prussian War, not the Germans. Right. Prussian leader Bismarck Wright meets with the defeated Napoleon III. January of 1871, German states declare unity. Globalists seek to control new German empire. The Prussian-German victory over France brings about the unification of the German states under the Kaiser, or King, Wilhelm I of Prussia. United Germany will soon become the main economic power of continental Europe, with one of the most powerful and professional armies in the world. Meanwhile, back in England, the globalists plot to control the new German nation. Although Jewish bankers thrive in Germany, Germany, like Tsar Alexander's Russia, has the capacity to shape its own destiny and thwart the ambitions of the City of London. Not only is German politics outside of the Rothschild's total control, but the fact that several German royals are intermarried with British nobility complicates the city's ability to menace Germany with British power. It will be 48 years before the new German nation can be brought under the thumb of the New World Order, but the long-range plan goes into effect immediately. Rothschild's agent and future, as well as ex-British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, plots against both Germany and Russia. The voluntary unification of the German states gives rise to a great German Reich. So this is the Empire of Russia, which I think this right here today, this area, if I remember correctly, this area, let's see here. Come on. Oh, it doesn't work. It's not going to work. But this area right here is, this area right here is Poland. So, 1871, the new German Reich grants citizenship rights to Jews. The Jews of Germany proper are prosper. Otto von Bismarck is the chancellor of the new German Reich under Kaiser Wilhelm I. Though his skilled and energetic, or through his skilled and energetic diplomacy, he will keep Germany out of the war and the rest of Europe at peace. Soon after United Germany is established, Bismarck's government becomes the first European nation to grant citizenship privileges to its Jewish population. too, even Rothschild's England has yet to do this. The UK's Jewish Prime Minister Disraeli holds office because he had converted to Christianity. By the end of the 1800s, this remarkable people will have obtained a great degree of influence over German commerce, universities, press, politics, arts, and central banking. And Bismarck, the political father of the German Reich, treated the Jews very well. They prospered in tolerant Germany. And obviously, Bismarck is obviously the gentleman for which the battleship was named. In 1874, Reds attempt to kill Chancellor Bismarck. A Jewish Red named Frederick Cohen. By the way, Red, if you don't know what that means, I'm going to assume that you don't. It just basically means communist. A Jewish Red named Frederick Cohen had previously shot Bismarck when he was Prime Minister of Prussia in 1866. Now, in 1874, terrorist Edward Kuhlmann attempts to assassinate Chancellor Bismarck. Kuhlmann's gunshot strikes Bismarck's hand. Kaiser Wilhelm I and Chancellor von Bismarck are the peacemakers of Europe, but the New World Order crime gang would like these leaders dead so that mighty Germany can be subdued under their thumb. October of 1873, Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Russia form the League of the Three Emperors. Chancellor Bismarck negotiates an agreement between the monarchs of Austria-Hungary, that's Emperor Franz Joseph, Russia, Tsar Alexander II, and Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm I. The alliance, known as the League of the Three Emperors, has three purposes. Number one, the League serves as a mutual defense against the growing Red movements, which have menaced Europe with violence since 1848. The League will avoid war amongst each other and or when diplomacy can resolve differences. Three, the League opposes the expansion of French and British power, as well as plots to threaten the internal order of their countries. The military and financial power of these three empires forms a central southern Eastern Europe power base that the Rothschilds and their British and French hitmen cannot control. There can be no new world order until this mighty defensive coalition of empires is somehow broken up and individually smashed. British cartoon on the left, Mark, mocks the Three Emperors League. Bismarck is depicted as the puppet master of the emperors. And that's this right here. 1877-78, Russia defeats the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, in the Russo-Turkish War. There are two main causes of the Russo-Turkish War. First, Russia desires to reclaim vital Black Sea territory lost in the Rothschild finance Crimean War of 20 years earlier. The other objective, or at least the other stated objective, is to liberate the Orthodox Christian Slavic populations of the Balkan states. Russia's Orthodox and Christian, Orthodox Christian and Slavic allies, Serbia, Montenegro, Romania, and Bulgaria, all rebel against Turkey and fight with Russia. Claims of Turkish mistreatment of Bulgarian Christians further upset the Russians. Russia dominates the fighting and begins advancing towards Istanbul or Constantinople. Dismayed that Russia may capture Constantinople and even Palestine from the beaten Turkish Empire, Britain's Jewish Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli pressures Russia to accept a truce offered by Turkey. Britain sends ships to the area to intimidate Russia and force a peace conference in Berlin, Germany. And this is the Balkans area right in here. This is the Black Sea. This is right now today. This is Crimea, Sevastopol. This is Romania, Austria. This is Bosnia, Serbia. This is Greece, Turkey, all this area in here. This is all the Balkans. So I don't know if you can see my cursor on the screen. Okay. May 11th and June 2nd of 1878, Reds make two assassination attempts against Kaiser Wilhelm I, just days before the important international conference is due to take place in Berlin. Two assassination attempts are made against Kaiser Wilhelm I. On May 11th, 1878, a Red named Emil Max Hodel fires shots at the emperor and his daughter as they travel in their carriage. Hodel is captured and then executed in August. 3 weeks later, another Red named Karl Nobling fires a gun at the emperor. The 82-year-old Kaiser is wounded, but he survives. Nobling then shoots himself and dies 3 months later. The New World Order's secret war against the Three Emperors League and all of Europe's Christian monarchs is really starting to heat up. Let's see here. June of 1878. Benjamin Disraeli plans dirty tricks in Berlin. Rothschild and British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli dominates the conference, which was called into session to settle the Russo-Turkish War. Britain, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Russia, France, Italy, and Turkey attend the Congress of Berlin. The Ottoman Turks still have control of the Holy Land, but Britain and the Rothschilds will wish to ultimately take over Palestine. Russia is committed to the protection of the Orthodox Christians throughout Southern Europe and Turkey. Before Congress opens, Disraeli concludes a secret deal with Turkey against Russia, in which Britain will keep the strategic island of Cyprus. This gives Disraeli an advantage, leading him to issue threats of war if Russia doesn't comply with the demands of the Turks, who had lost the war. Another dirty pre-Congress deal is struck between Disraeli and Russia, soon to be ex-ally, Austria-Hungary. Slavic Orthodox Christians, including the Serbs and the Serbs of Bosnia, are put under Austria-Hungary's rule. Russia and its Slavic allies had won the war against Turkey, but now many of the Slavs are to be transferred from the Turkish rule to Austro-Hungarian rule. This breeds resentment among the Slavic subjects of Austria-Hungary, especially the Serbs of Bosnia, who are forbidden from uniting with the independent nation of Serbia. Intriguers have put a permanent wedge between Russia and Austria-Hungary. So this is a picture or a cartoon of Disraeli dominated the Berlin Congress and undermined its host. Bismarck left. The victorious Russians weren't happy about the deal, nor were their Bulgarian allies, nor were the Serbs living in Austria-Hungary and Bosnia. And that's all this right here. So this all at one time. I mean, it was all independent states, what they call Balkanized. But at one time, they all came together under the banner of Yugoslavia. That isn't until later. June of 1878, Disraeli's dirty tricks caused the breakup of the Three Emperors League. Chancellor Bismarck tries to keep the Disraeli-engineered controversies from breaking up the Three Emperors League, but the humiliation of Russia at the hands of Britain, Turkey, and Austria-Hungary is too much to bear. Russia pulls out of the league instead of being allied with Germany, whom Disraeli also wants to isolate. Russia is now cut off from her and placed in a position where it can be played off against Germany's ally, Austria-Hungary, a classic divide-and-conquer scheme. The foundation of the Great War of 1914-18, or World War I, was laid at the cross of Berlin, thanks to the dirty work of the globalist Zionist Benjamin Disraeli. Upon retiring to England, Disraeli boasts to Queen Victoria of how he killed the Three Emperors League. Interesting. By causing the three Emperors League to split, Dirty Disraeli laid the foundation for the global blood paths of the next century. Image 3 is a cartoon from that era depicting Disraeli carrying the beaten Turks to victory at the Congress of Berlin. That's this one right here, I'm guessing. Forbidden history, quote, to remember, our great object was to break up and permanently prevent the alliance of the three empires. And I maintain there was never a greater or a never, there never was a general diplomatic result more completely affected. That was quoted by Benjamin Disraeli. The Grand Young Man cartoon on the right depicts Disraeli as the unseen power behind Parliament. Lord Randolph Churchill, the alleged father of future Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Interesting. So the Grand Young Man cartoon on the right depicts Disraeli as the unseen power behind Lord Randolph Churchill. Wow. I did not know that. 1882, the Anglo-Egyptian War. Rothschild's Britain advances towards Palestine. The Zionists dream of one day capturing the Holy Land currently under the Ottoman Turks' control. Recall how years earlier, with Ottoman Turkey on the brink of total defeat, Benjamin Disraeli intervened to keep the Russians away from Palestine. Now the Zionists are positioning their chess pieces towards the next step. When the British-French Suez Canal opens in 1869, it is Benjamin Disraeli's Britain with Rothschild financing that pushes or that purchases enough shares to make Britain the main shareholder of the waterway linking the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. By 1882, the canal's host nation, Britain or Egypt, is being treated like a colonial subject of Britain. Always waging war under false pretenses, Rothschild's UK attack dog picks a fight with Egypt under the pretext of protecting the Suez Canal. During the Anglo-Egyptian War, the British bomb Alexandria and invade Cairo. Rothschild's Britain becomes master of Egypt. During World War I, Egypt, which borders Palestine, will be a useful staging area, a staging post to launch attacks on Turkey. Palestine, or Israel, is now within the Zionist Rothschild family's reach. And this is kind of important to know here. Egypt's strategy, location, and proximity to Palestine are coveted by the Rothschilds. And let me show you here. I'm going to take a break here for a second and open something up and so you guys can see something here. Okay. So, sorry, flat earthers, if you don't like this, this is Google Earth. It's not mine. Let's say that you were in, Mumbai. Okay. You're in the port of Mumbai. And you want to take something by ship to London, all right? So let's do a path. Go here, to here, to here, here, around Cape Town. Actually, we're probably going to go up to like Liverpool. Where's Liverpool? Thought it was in here. Whatever. Doesn't matter. Call it there. That's close enough for government work. All right. That is 12,600 miles. Okay. It's 12,600 miles. Now, let's clear that. And let's do the same thing, but with the Suez Canal. Okay. So we'll start in Mumbai. We're going to go down here into the Gulf of Aden. Come up here. Up through the Suez Canal. Into the Mediterranean. Through the Straits of Gibraltar. So that's 7,000 miles. So that cuts it in half, almost. Cuts that trip almost in half. And you don't have to go through the rough waters of the... What is this? The Cape of Good Hope? I forgot what this is. Or this Cape Horn. I don't remember. It's Cape of Good Hope or Cape Horn. I don't remember. Whatever. It doesn't really matter. The point of the matter is that the Suez Canal is extraordinarily strategic. Even to this day, it's massively strategic. And that is why the strategic location and proximity to Palestine are coveted by the Rothschilds. Just like the Panama Canal. Okay. June of 1887, the reassurance treaty, Germany and Russia form a secret alliance. Although the British Rothschild agent Disraeli had destroyed the Three Emperors League, Russia, Germany, Austria, Hungary, German Chancellor Bismarck continues to work for peace, to reassure the peace of Eastern Europe and to prevent British or French intrigue from starting more wars. Bismarck's Germany and Tsarist Romanov Russia agree to a secret treaty known as the Reinsurance Treaty. Under the terms of the agreement, Germany and Russia agree to remain neutral should either become involved in a war with a third nation. However, neutrality would not apply if Russia attacks Germany's ally, Austria-Hungary. That is extremely important. The neutrality would not apply if Russia attacks Germany's ally, Austria-Hungary. The two powers remain vulnerable to the Balkan controversy in Austria-Hungary. Russia is the protector of the minority Slavic Orthodox community under Austrian rule, and also of Slavic states like small Slavic states like Serbia. Nonetheless, the reinsurance treaty is a very good sign that Russia and Germany will be able to work out any future differences diplomatically. April 20th, 1889, Adolf Hitler is born. At a time when the dark forces of the New World Order were already setting the chess pieces for the future war to enslave Germany, Adolf Hitler, the man who would become their greatest nemesis, is born into a very simple Austrian family. 1890, new German Kaiser dismisses Bismarck, turns down Russian offer to renew the reinsurance treaty. Kaiser Wilhelm I passes away in March of 1888 at the age of 91. He is succeeded by his son, Frederick I, who dies of throat cancer after a reign of just 3 months. Frederick's 29-year-old son, Wilhelm II, then becomes Kaiser in June of 1888. Like many young, educated Europeans, Wilhelm II is particularly infected with the poisonous of liberalism, or the poison of liberalism. Whereas Iron Chancellor Bismarck wants to smash the Reds of Germany, young Wilhelm is hesitant to crush the communists. He believes that if Germany becomes more democratic, it will pacify the Red agitators. Wilhelm II also wants better relations with the UK, the enemy of Russia. To that end, Wilhelm, possibly under the influence of the NWO court intriguers, turns his back on Russia, refusing repeated Russian requests to renew Bismarck's reinsurance treaty. The irreconcilable differences lead Wilhelm to dismiss the legendary Bismarck in 1890. As the grandson of Britain's Queen Victoria, Wilhelm eventually believes that he can trust and befriend Britain, which really belongs to the Rothschilds, not Victoria. He also believes that he can solve problems with Russia by negotiation. Russia now feels isolated and mistrusts Germany's ally, Austria-Hungary. This leaves Russia very vulnerable to French and British intrigue. History will prove that wise old Bismarck was right and naive young Wilhelm was wrong. Dropping the pilot, British cartoon mocks the dismissal of the great statesman and peacemaker. Bad move, Kaiser Wilhelm. January of 1894, Russia entangled into a Franco-Russian alliance. Isolated from Germany and suspicious of Austria-Hungary, Russia, which wants another crack at Turkey, falls into a clever trap set by France, which wants another crack at Prussia, Germany, and Rothschild New World Order agents, who have a much bigger picture in mind. The Franco-Russian alliance creates an entangled military alliance between the two nations. The Russian giant can now be used to create a deadly second front in any future war with Germany. This is what German Chancellor Bismarck had worked so hard to avoid. The great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace, passionately condemns the Franco-Russian alliance as a French trick to entangle Russia in a future war against France's enemy, Germany. Tolstoy sarcastically describes the suddenly friendly French as people who, without reason, suddenly professed such spontaneous and exceptional love for Russia. Um, 1896, globalist Zionists purchased the New York Times. Since its founding in 1851 by Republican Henry Jarvis Raymond, the New York Times has been a big player in shaping public opinion. In 1896, the Times takes a turn to the internationalist left when it is purchased by a German Jew named Adolf Oakes. In 1897, Oakes himself coins the paper's self-serving slogan, "All the news that's fit to print." I'm sure you guys have heard that saying 1,000 times. Oakes' daughter marries Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, who will become publisher when Adolf dies. Oakes' great-grandson, Arthur Oakes Sulzberger Jr., is the publisher of the Times today. For 120 years, America's most influential rag has been in the hands of the same Zionist Marxist family. Count on the Times to promote big government globalism, phony environmentalism, Israel, the Fed, and endless foreign wars. I presume that, see what page am I on here? This is page 27. I presume that it's, this is 2018. So I'm guessing that that's, as of 2018, that's what he was saying, that the, that this guy was the publisher as of 2018. The New York Times, above Adolf Oakes, the awesome power and influence of the New York Times, Jewish Oakes and Sulzberger dynasty cannot be denied. August of 1897, the first Zionist Congress meets in Basel, Switzerland. The plot to seal Palestine is hatched. The first Zionist Congress is held in Basel, Switzerland, and is chaired by Theodor Herzl. Jewish delegates from across Europe agree that Palestine should be given to them. The idea of a Jewish takeover of Palestine has been floating around Britain for decades. Whenever Russia advanced its interests in the area, Rothschild's Britain would keep Russia out. The problem is that Palestine is 95% Arab and falls under the sovereignty of the Ottoman Turks. Unless the Turks agree to give Palestine to the Jews, the Zionist dream cannot be realized. In 1901, the Zionists will offer to arrange a reduction of Turkey's foreign debt owed by the Zionist bankers in exchange for Palestine. The Sultan of Turkey bluntly refuses. Giving away the Holy Land to the Zionists would be a betrayal of Turkey's and Palestine's Muslim population. Herzl refuses to give up. The British offer to give the Jews part of the African colony of Uganda. The Zionists refuse, insisting upon Palestine. Prior to his death in 1904, Herzl predicts that a world body will one day give Palestine to the Jews and that he will go down in history as the father of the Jewish state. For Herzl's dream to come true, a European military power will have to be manipulated into taking Palestine away from the Ottomans by force. And this is Theodor Herzl right here. Palestine lies deep within Ottoman territory, but Herzl has a long-range plan. He speaks of the future world body that will give the Jews a homeland in Palestine. Future world body, possibly, I don't know, let's see, the United Nations? Just putting it out there. December 8th, 1897, the dying Bismarck's final warning and prediction. Former German Chancellor Bismarck is now 83 years old and in poor health. Kaiser Wilhelm II visits Bismarck for the last time in December of 1897. Again, the wise old man warns of Kaiser to beware of the intrigues of courtiers around him and of a European disaster that may yet still come. Bismarck warns Wilhelm not to trust court advisors. Your Majesty, so long as you have the present officer corps, you can do as you please. But when this is no longer the case, it will be very different for you. Subsequently, Bismarck makes these accurate predictions. The crash will come 20 years after my departure. If things go on like this, one day the great European war will come out of some damned foolish thing in the Balkans. This prophecy will be fulfilled almost to the year. Bismarck knows that the Balkan crisis may result in a two-front war against Britain and France in the West, Russia in the East. Plus an internal red uprising on the home front. In 1898, U.S. starts a war with Spain to gain a globalist foothold in Asia Pacific. Using the ridiculous pretext of liberating Cuba and a false accusation against Spain for the sinking of the USS Maine, a warmongering faction of the American Congress and Yellow Press are able to impose the phony Spanish-American War upon a very reluctant President William McKinley. The true purpose of the war is to take Spain's Pacific Ocean naval base in the Philippines and Guam. The crisis of the war is also used to pass a congressional decree to annex Hawaii as a U.S. territory against the wishes of the native Hawaiians. The Spanish-American War, as the U.S.-Philippines War, which grows out of it, are major turning points in the globalist drive to dominate East Asia. These events mark the true origin of the war with Japan, which is to come 43 years later. And this is within 24 hours of the start of the war to free Cuba. Acting Naval Secretary Theodore Roosevelt ordered Commodore Dewey to destroy the Spanish fleet in the Philippines. The true long-range purpose was to achieve dominance over Asia. April 1904, Entente Cordiale, the UK and France form an alliance. Germany is suspicious. The Entente Cordiale is a series of agreements signed between France and Great Britain. The agreements settle issues regarding colonial expansion and the mark of the end of a centuries-old era of on-and-off conflict between France and Britain. Germany views the new alliance with great suspicion, especially because France had already allied itself with Russia in 1892, the chess pieces of Europe are clearly being set in preparation of the big game to come. The Anglo-French alliance will one day entangle the United States as well. These nations will serve as the military hitmen of the New World Order. German cartoon John Bull, UK, walks by his French whore as an armed Germany looks on with suspicion. The forerunner of modern day NATO is born. 1905, Zionist bankers and Reds attempt a revolution in Russia. For a lot of you guys who may or may not know, everybody talks about the Russian Revolution of 1917, but very few people are aware that the first revolution that was tried to turn Russia into a communist state was tried in 1905. The attempted Russian Revolution in 1905 is a wave of political uprisings, massive labor strikes, and terrorist acts against the government of Russia. The Reds, under orders from their Rothschild shift masters, used the discontent surrounding the loss of war with Japan, financed by Schiff, to foment the revolution. From 1905 to 1909, Red terrorists will kill 7,300 people and wound about 8,000. Though the Jewish-inspired Red Revolution is suppressed, Tsar Nicholas II is forced to make democratic concessions which weaken his power and set him up for a future attempt. Nicholas makes a critical mistake by showing mercy to Red leaders such as Lenin and Trotsky instead of executing the Marxist leaders. The Russians merely arrest or deport them. Lenin finds his way to Switzerland and Trotsky ends up in New York after escaping from prison. The exiled communists will one day return with more money from the Zionist bankers to terrorize Christian Russia once again. Let's see here. Forbidden history quote to remember. The Jews have undoubtedly to a large extent furnished the brains and energy in the revolution throughout Russia. George von Lungerk, U.S. ambassador to Russia. 1905, the mysterious protocols of the learned elders of Zion is published in Russia. Russian professor Sergei Nelius publishes the full version of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, a controversial document discovered a few years earlier. The protocols are alleged to be the minutes of a secret meeting of the Jewish elites in which a master plan for world domination to be compromised or to be completed over the next 100 years is laid out in chilling detail. The protocols tell of Jewish control of world banking, world media, communism, liberalism, and political parties of every type. The master plot includes plans to destroy the Catholic Church and all Christianity, promote atheism, wage class warfare, labor against management, overthrow Tsarist Russia, corrupt the morals of the people, promote senseless modern art and dirty literature, use anti-Semitism to keep lesser Jews cohesive, manipulate women with ideas of liberation, create economic depressions and inflations, create controlled opposition to themselves, use state debt as a weapon to enslave countries, subvert and control all existing governments, install tainted politicians that can be blackmailed, manipulate college students with phony idealism, assassinate world leaders, spread deadly diseases, use balance of power politics to control nations, commit acts of terrorism, promote sports and games to divert people, start a world war which will include the United States, set up world government after an economic crash. Wow. That's pretty interesting that they got almost all that stuff right. Some allege that the protocols were forged by Russian security agents in order to convince the Tsar of the New World Order's existence, although the authenticity of the document remains in question. World events of the coming decades will match the protocol so closely that the document becomes a worldwide sensation during the 1920s and 30s. Forgery or not, whoever wrote it had an unusual knowledge and a spooky prescience, so much so that so many in Europe take it very seriously. Professor Neely has translated the protocols, since translated widely. March 25th of 1906, Zionist on New York Times publishes a false claim that 6 million Jews face extermination in Russia. Smaller newspapers later pick up the claim too. In 1907, Triple Entente brings Europe closer to war. The Triple Entente, from the French word entente or agreement, is a military alliance between the UK, France, and Russia, concluded after the signing of the British-Russian Entente in 1907. Of course, Britain is not allying with Russia out of any friendship. The globalist goal is to draw Russia into fighting Germany and Austria-Hungary from the east. After Russia, Germany, and Austria-Hungary exhaust themselves, all three former allies can then be subverted from within by communists and or liberals controlled by the globalists. The Triple Entente is the counterweight to the 1982 Triple Alliance, or Central Powers of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. Rothschild and Warburg agents are also at work with the Triple Alliance. Italy later switches sides and is replaced by the Ottoman Empire, which is Russia's nemesis. The two allies have been cleverly set up as mechanisms for the purpose of triggering the coming world war to rearrange Europe and the world. One of the incidents in the Balkan region of southern Austria-Hungary is all that will take to ignite the two alliance powder kegs and drag the powers of Europe and America into a massive war. The New World Order and its agents will skillfully manipulate the patriotic passion of the world's various nations so as to bring about a disaster that will benefit Zionism, communism, and globalism. November 1912, New World Order gang captures the U.S. presidency. Teddy Roosevelt runs interference for Wilson. After decades of strategic political preparation, the New World Order has seven major goals it wants to achieve in the coming decade. Establish a central bank in the United States. Impose an income tax on America so that the state debt to the central bank can be collateralized with human labor. Trigger the long-planned Triple Entente, Triple Alliance war to reshape Europe. Entangle the United States in the coming war and world organization. Finish off Russia and convert the Eurasian giant into a red tyranny. Establish a world political body under the pretext of world peace. Carry out Herzl's plan to steal Palestine from the Turks and Arabs. Popular U.S. President William Howard Taft will never involve America in such a treasonous schemes, so the globalists recruit Woodrow Wilson, a Princeton professor who is rocketed to governor of New Jersey, then to the Democratic nominee for the president, to steal Republican votes from Taft. Ex-President Roosevelt runs as a Progressive Party candidate, a.k.a. Bull Moose. The divide-and-conquer trick works. Due to Teddy Roosevelt's meddling, Wilson wins with just 41% of the vote. Very similar to what happened with Ross Perot in 1992 when he ran and George Bush lost and Bill Clinton won. Not that I was really a fan of either of those two people, but just putting it out there. Teddy Roosevelt's interference undermined Taft Center and enabled puppet Wilson Wright to become president and make a huge mess of the world. 1910 to 1920, new American Zionist kingpins emergence. The Rothschild orbit includes other Zionist bankers who emerge as giants in their own right. These American moguls will dominate the 8 years presidency of the of their pathetic puppet, Woody Wilson. Jacob Schiff, the Schiff's family declared a home with the Rothschilds in the 1700s. Schiff helped Japan defeat Russia in 1905. He also funds the NAACP and the ADL. Bernard Baruch, Baruch first introduced Wilson to the wealthy Jewish community of New York City. According to one account, Baruch led Wilson as one would a poodle on a string. During World War I, Baruch will head up Wilson's War Industries Board, making him the most powerful figure in American industry. The Warburg brothers, German banker Paul Warburg, will soon become the father of the U.S. Federal Reserve, a private banking and stock manipulation syndicate which collects interest for the privilege of printing the nation's currency. His son, James, will set up the United World Federalists in 1947 to openly promote the world government. His brother, Max, is a very powerful banker in Germany, and his older brother, Felix, a philanthropist, uses his fortune to promote global Zionist causes. Interesting. All right, we're on page 37. I want to find something here. Because there's something that I want to show y'all. Let me find here. Let me see here. Come on now. Oh, reading this is actually it's my eyes are getting a little strained. Come on. I'm having a little bit of a difficult time. It's not the easiest thing when you're doing this like this. It's harder than it looks, believe me. But I'm trying. So, okay, here it is. This is what I wanted to show you guys. So there's this and then this. Okay, so let me find the... All right, I'm going to check the chat here because I haven't looked at, I haven't been paying attention to the chat. And we got 120 people here tonight, which actually isn't too terrible. But I imagine that the topic that I'm covering probably isn't very sexy. So it's, but that's all right. I don't care. This is actually going to be... This to me is very fascinating history because understanding World War II is probably one of the most crucial components to understanding the world that we live in. And it was Mike King who talked about that. And some of you guys probably weren't here when I was talking about this, but I had a conversation with Mike King today. And he's the gentleman who I had on a couple weeks ago when we talked about Q, and the 120-year plan. And he has agreed to come on every Tuesday night, and we are going to have probably about an hour-long program every Tuesday night after the Constitution class in perpetuity. So, so he will be a regular guest every Tuesday evening, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of really interesting stuff in reference to history. I am extraordinarily excited about that because Mike is just a wealth of knowledge, and to be able to have him on my channel every single Tuesday night is in my opinion, is a huge coup. So he's just is super intelligent. Okay, so I don't know if I've read this to you guys, but let me get some water. Okay. This is this is a copy of a book called FDR, My Exploited Father-in-Law, by Curtis B. Dahl. And in it, there's a on page, starting on page 136 here in the lower corner. I don't know, I'm hoping you guys can see it. In 1912, the Democrat Party headquarters in New York City was located on Lower Fifth Avenue. A good friend of mine, then a young man, spent considerable time at the headquarters working as a sort of messenger boy. He was the son of a well-known New York family of Judaic background, and he related to me the following intriguing story, which occurred right before his eyes. Occasionally on a Saturday morning in the summer of 1912, Bernard Baruch would walk into the Democratic headquarters with Woodrow Wilson in tow, leading him like one would a poodle on a string. That's where then you get that quote from. Wilson would be quite solemn face and appearance, dressed in dark formal clothes, having just arrived in New York from Trenton. According to my friend, Wilson would be given his special indoctrination course in politics by several of the top advisors assembled there. The course consisted chiefly of outlining to him and his agreeing in principle to, number one, aiding in pushing the projected Federal Reserve Bank legislation through Congress when Paul Warburg approved the final draft of the proposed act then being worked on. That was the Federal Reserve Act. Two, aiding in changing the method of electing U.S. senators by establishing a direct vote of the people, which provided more control over the Senate by the professional politicians. So what that meant is by the 17th Amendment completely overrode the electoral process of how senators were elected. Because you've got to remember that in our bicameral House of Government, we have the House of Representatives, which is which represents the people. That's what the people vote on. The Senate is not, the Senate does not represent the people in the legislative process. The Senate represents the states. The state governments are the constituency of the of the government. So the House of Representatives constituency is the people, whereas the state government's constituency is the, or the senators or the, is the constituency of the Senate. All right. So normally, what is supposed, the way the federal government was designed to be, was that the state senates or the state senates would vote, or the state governments rather would vote for the people to represent the state governments at the federal government level. All right. The 17th Amendment abolished that, and it essentially made the state, it essentially made the Senate a glorified House of Representatives. All right. Number three, agreeing to aid and introduce the graduated personal income tax, which was brought over from England to drain off the results of our individual initiative. All right. So the Federal Reserve Act and the 16th Amendment are two planks of the Communist Manifesto. Number four, if called upon to lead a sympathetic ear to aid indicated policy if war should break out in Europe. All right. This is before the 2019-12 election, and they were already telling whoever was going to be running for president that if war was going to break out in Europe, that you were going to support the war. Think about that. This is a full almost 3 years before the election, or before the war broke out. They knew it was going to come. And then five, to lend a thoughtful ear on recommendations made by quote unquote policy in respect to finding key cabinet posts. So, Wilson dutifully received and absorbed his indoctrination, shook hands all around, and then departed. Whereupon the leaders and the advisors went into the back room and the headquarters shut the door and had a big belly laugh. Someone would then ask, "How's our other candidate doing?" The other candidate was Teddy Roosevelt, the Bull Moose leader. Hence, the strong support of that steering committee in the 1912 election went out to both Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, who had lined up against President Taft. It appeared that President Taft had not been very receptive and disapproved of the political desires expressed by the certain pro-Zionist political leaders here in respect to the United States relations with Russia. Thus, the Republican vote was nearly split, but the insurgent Bull Moosers and the Democratic candidate Woodrow Wilson won. So, all nasty stuff. Politics is just, you know, I mean, this is all the stuff that, that happened. And we are living in the consequences today as a result of all this stuff. That's horrible. Yeah, see right here. This is Baruch would often walk into the Democratic headquarters in 1912 with Wilson in tow, leading him like one, a poodle on a string, Curtis B. Dahl, son-in-law's FDR. So that was that book that I just read you there, that little sample of the book. Other Zionist globalist power players of that era, Louis Brandeis, Samuel Untermeyer, Chaim Weizmann, Rabbi Stephen Wise. Against our better judgment by journalists and historian Allison Weir reveals how early Zionists manipulated Wilson and others. That sounds like something, actually sounds like a book I need to get. Against our better judgment. Let me pause this here for a second. I'm going to. Look it up just for a second. Let's see if I can find it. Here it is. Okay. All right, here. Where are we here, guys? I'm sorry. I hope I'm not boring you guys. This is this stuff is fascinating to me, but it's it can be a little dry. And a lot of this stuff is, you've got to understand, this is kind of like the building up of the story, right? This is the building up of the of everything that's happening in the in World War II. All the stuff that's happening right now, it's like the chess moves are being made on the chessboard. Okay, section 2, 1914-18, a summary of World War I and the Russian Revolution. June 28th of 1914, to kick off their long-awaited pre-planned world war, the New World Order uses Serbian nationalists, a secret society known as Young Bosnia, possibly working with the Young Turks, plot the murder of an Austrian royal. Serbia is an Orthodox Christian nation under the protection of Russia due to Disraeli's past schemes. Many Serbs also live under Austria-Hungary, Hungarian rule in Bosnia instead of under Serbian sovereignty. This situation has always caused friction both with Austria-Hungary and also between Russia and Austria-Hungary. Archduke Franz Ferdinand is heir to the Habsburg family throne of Austria-Hungary. While traveling through the Bosnian city of Sarajevo with his wife Sophie, a bomb is thrown at the Archduke's open car. He deflects the bomb with his arm and it explodes behind him. The royal couple insists on seeing all those injured at the hospital. After traveling there, they decide to go to the palace, but their driver takes the wrong turn onto the side street, where another assassin named Gavril Princip when witnesses arrive to give aid, spots them. He shoots Sophie in the stomach and Franz in the neck. Franz is still alive when witnesses arrive to give aid. His dying words to Sophie are, "Don't die, darling. Live for our children." Back in July 1912, still just 36, Winston Churchill, the unaccomplished but well-connected drunkard, had been named as First Lord of the British Admiralty and charged with the task of putting the British fleet into the state of instant readiness for war. The events of that fateful first month of the Great War, July and August of 1914, greatly excite the British mad dog, who writes all the time to his wife, "Everything tends towards catastrophe and collapse. I am interested, geared up, and happy. It is not horrible to be built like that. Or is it not horrible to be built like that? The preparations have a hideous fascination for me. I pray to God to forgive me for such fearful moods of levity. Come on. Sometimes my computer screen just blacks out, but it came back. I pray to God to forgive me for such fearful moods of levity. Yet I would do my best for peace, and nothing would induce me wrongfully to strike the blow. Churchill knows very well that the Austro-Hungary and especially Germany are being maneuvered into striking the first blow, but there are sensible heads in Britain who would like to avoid the coming disaster, which Churchill and others are determined to unleash. Once one such man, UK Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith, who expresses his grave concerns about Churchill after meeting with him. Winston, very bellicose and demanding immediate mobilization. Winston, who has got all of his war paint on, is longing for a sea fight in the early hours of the morning to result in the sinking of the Goeben. The whole thing fills me with sadness. Prime Minister Asquith was a reluctant warrior who would not be able to resist the force of Admiralty Lords Churchill and Britain's warmongering faction. The first great bloodbath of the 20th century was about to begin. Prime Minister Asquith was horrified with Churchill's scheme to draw first blood against Germany by sinking the SS Goeben. Summer 1914. Post-assassination chain reaction sets Europe on fire. All righty. I think I'm going to stop here, guys. I'm getting a little tired. I didn't sleep very well last night. So, and I feel like I'm not really doing this, the giving it the justice that it deserves. We're not doing the class tomorrow. So I may actually come on a little bit early tomorrow and maybe even do a couple of readings of this to get through it. So I might do a part 2 and 3. Tomorrow. So, and this is, I'm about an hour and a half. So that's a good amount of time. So I'm at page 41 here. So I'm going to go ahead and, call it for tonight. Not because I'm just getting a little weary, a little tired. So, and I want to be able to do you guys right. I want to be able to, if I'm going to do this, I want to do it right. So it's not, so I'm not putting you all to sleep. So this isn't a bedtime story. This is like serious, real history. So I want to be able to do it. I want to make sure that I'm doing you guys a good service. So you tune into me for good stuff, for good content. And I want to make sure that I give that to you. So, alrighty guys. Well, on that note, I pray that you all have a wonderful evening. Enjoy your Monday night. And, I look forward to seeing you guys mañana. So everybody have a wonderful night, and, I will see you guys in the morrow. Have a good night, everybody. Have